May it please the court, counsel, Alan Epstein representing defendant Russell Hart. The issue defendant raises on appeal is whether the trial court abused its discretion in admitting plaintiff's treating doctor's testimony that plaintiff would need future medical care in the form of surgical fusion costing between $100,000 and $125,000, rhizotomies costing $5,000, and trigger point injections costing $250 per visit when the only medical expenses plaintiff identified in the trial management order were past medical expenses in the amount of $9,282. Under Rules 26 and 16, each party is required to provide a description of the categories of damages sought and a computation of any category of economic damages claimed. Past medical expenses and future medical expenses are separate and distinct categories of economic damages. Prior to trial, defendant filed a motion in limine to exclude Dr. Limebeck's recent report and from testifying to future medical treatment and costs, arguing the time to disclose additional witnesses for defendant had passed and there was insufficient time to conduct additional discovery. The trial court entertained motions in limine on the first day of trial, the morning of the first day of trial, and it was not until that time that plaintiff first disclosed what Dr. Limebeck would say were the costs associated with future medical treatment. The trial court inquired of plaintiff's counsel when he learned of those of that information, to which plaintiff's counsel responded that he had heard about the costs the prior day, to which the trial court responded, quote, Dr. Limebeck's going to have to testify within the confines of what's been disclosed, and what may or may not be your lack of knowledge does not justify, in my view, not providing full disclosure should that be the case to the other side. However, during trial, plaintiff began to examine Dr. Limebeck regarding his opinions of plaintiff's future medical care, including surgery and rehabilitation. At this point, defendant objected and the court held a bench conference. Defendant's counsel argued, this is an issue that came up pre-trial. He is testifying outside the four corners of his records. He said in his record that he may possibly need surgery, and now he's talking about rehabilitation. He's going to get into costs soon. Notwithstanding its earlier ruling, the court's response to defendant's objection was to overrule it, stating you can cross-examine him. Plaintiff was then permitted to elicit from Dr. Limebeck the cost of future medical procedures, which were disclosed for the first time earlier that morning. The jury awarded approximately $92,000 in economic damages, where the only economic damages claimed were medical expenses, and the only medical expenses plaintiff identified in the trial management order were $9,282 in past medical expenses. Plaintiff argues that defendant did not preserve this issue because defense counsel did not object to Dr. Limebeck's testimony. But as I just described, defendant's counsel did object to Dr. Limebeck's testimony, specifically flagged the costs issue, and the trial court overruled his objection, stating you can cross-examine him, which
I'm sorry for interrupting, Mr. Epstein. I'm wondering if I could take you back to the disclosure by the plaintiff to the defense that occurred about 5 days before the end of discovery. Is there any indication in the record that anything happened in those 5 days? For example, did defendant file an objection at that point? Did defendant make inquiry to determine more information? Did anything happen in that 5 days?
Is Your Honor referring to the Dr. Limebeck's May 2013 report?
Yeah, this was the disclosure that the plaintiff would need future medical care and specific reference to trigger point injections, facet injections, and surgery. That was a medical record that was disclosed to the defense about 5 days before the end of discovery.
What was done was to file the motion in limine. There wasn't anything else done.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
In any event, getting back to what I was speaking to earlier, I believe that defendant's counsel clearly did preserve this issue. He did object specifically to evidence coming in through Dr. Lineback regarding costs of future medical treatment, and the trial court overruled that objection by stating you can cross-examine him. Defendant's counsel didn't have to object twice. The plaintiff argues that defendant opened the door to Dr. Lineback's testimony by advancing a failure to mitigate defense. This failure to mitigate defense went to plaintiff's past conduct, not what he would do, what he was going to do in the future, which was what Dr. Lineback's anticipated testimony was directed to. In any event, the presentation of claims or defenses does not open the door to contrary evidence not properly disclosed under the rules. Taking this argument to its logical conclusion, a defendant would never have to disclose liability or damages evidence under Rules 26 and 16, since a plaintiff will necessarily open the door to contrary evidence by presenting the plaintiff's case in chief on liability and damages. Plaintiff also argues that defendant is not entitled to a new trial because the jury's economic damages verdict is supported by the record. If plaintiff is arguing that the jury could have inferred future medical expenses from evidence other than Dr. Lineback's testimony, then it is impossible to determine from the jury's verdict on what evidence its award was based. Therefore, the introduction of Dr. Lineback's testimony was necessarily prejudicial, since the jury could have relied on it in reaching its verdict. Otherwise, the fact that the jury's verdict is supported by the evidence is irrelevant because defendant is not arguing that it isn't supported by the record, but that's not the issue on appeal. And unless there are further questions, since this is a one-issue appeal, defendant requests that this court reverse.
Mr. Epstein, I actually have a question. Okay. In the motion in limine that defendant filed, it's my understanding that it was to prevent introduction of the latest medical record from the plaintiff's doctor, which mentioned the potential need for future surgery. Did that motion rely upon or allege any error in the plaintiff's disclosures under Rule 16 F35, or did the motion mention Rule 26 A1C as the basis for the defendant's objections?
My recollection is that the motion did not specifically cite those rules, but those rules were implicit in the arguments made, and they were clearly implicit in the arguments made at trial when defendant's counsel objected on the basis that Dr. Lineback's testimony regarding costs had not been disclosed. Rule 26 and Rule 16 are disclosure rules.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
You've got about 6 minutes and 11 seconds left.
May it please the court, my name is Timms Fowler, and I represent Plaintiff North on this appeal. My registration number is 15983. Mr. North was injured in a motor vehicle accident, sustained various injuries. The case was tried before the Honorable Herbert Stern in Denver District Court, obviously an experienced trial judge in that district. Defendants framed the issue as though it was simply an issue about the admission of certain evidence. Their framing of the issue, however, ignores the other issues that are embedded in that, and that's simply whether there was proper preservation of the issue, meaning was there a contemporaneous objection made, which there was not. It also assumes that the body of the evidence taken as a whole, applying the legal standards to the verdict, means that the verdict is unsupported by any evidence in the record, which is not the case. There's ample evidence to support the damages verdict for economic losses of $95,000, just over $95,000. So the controlling issue really is whether the verdict is supported by some evidence in the record. Those are the standards. Now, to put the case in some context, it is worthwhile to note that the defendant never deposed the treating physicians for Mr. North, Drs. Limbach or Murphy. Dr. Murphy was a chiropractor. They never objected to their qualifications. They never offered a single exhibit at trial. They conceded negligence. They did not object to any jury instruction, particularly the damage instructions that say if it's difficult to ascertain damages, your job is to use your best judgment and determine what those damages may be, whether it be economic or non-economic. They did, and the defendant does not challenge any other portion of the verdict. They don't challenge physical impairment award, and they don't challenge the non-economic award. Thus, the jury has broad discretion, as the court well knows. You know the standards better than almost anybody, that the verdict will be viewed in the light most favorable to the plaintiff who obtained that verdict, and that the verdict need not be supported by some precise mathematical calculation. Okay, the verdict should be affirmed for three specific reasons. First, the motion in limine was properly denied by Judge Stern. There's no question about that. In fact, you don't hear the defendant either in their brief, opening brief, reply brief, or here contest otherwise. They don't say that the exclusion of the denial of the motion in limine and the admission of the January 28, 2013 chart note from Dr. Limbach was error. They don't assert that that's error. They only focus on the cost issues, that Dr. Limbach was permitted to testify at trial about the cost of the surgery, the injections, and the rhizotomy. Secondly, there's no contemporaneous objection lodged in the midst of trial. It's interesting that I attached as appendix to the actual colloquy of the initial objection by the defendant, I'll get into the specifics, but Dr. Limbach was testifying that after surgery there'd be some PT and rehab necessary. Defendant objected to that, to the rehab physical therapy portion. There was not an objection to the surgery. Judge Stern heard it and said, well, PT is usually required. I'll allow brief testimony on that. Then defense counsel, Mr. Neckers, said, well, Judge, plaintiff may get into costs. That's not an objection.
Defense counsel mentioned the possibility that the doctor was going to testify about costs before the trial court overruled the objection?
It was in that colloquy. I think it was before. He said that the plaintiff may get into costs. He noted that, but he didn't raise an objection, and there was no proffer of evidence about costs at that time. Only eight questions later, and about 2.5 pages of transcript later, did plaintiff's counsel inquire of Dr. Limbach what the costs may be. The rule requires, case law requires, a contemporaneous objection. That means two things as a practical matter. The whole purpose is so that the trial court's attention is drawn to that evidence and can make a ruling about the admission. Okay, it needs to be contemporaneous. That means when the evidence is offered, not after it's come in. Now, the defendant contends that there was a contemporaneous objection. Not so, and that's evidenced by both the subsequent conduct of defendant and the subsequent conduct of the court. When plaintiff's counsel inquired about costs from Dr. Limbach, there was no objection. Once it came in, there was no request for a curative instruction, no motion to strike by the defendant, no motion for mistrial, no post-trial motion, no relief was sought whatsoever. That's consistent with the record that represents that there was no contemporaneous objection. The trial court's conduct is also consistent with North's reading of the record. Had Judge Stern felt that plaintiff's counsel had overstepped an actual ruling, the judge would have admonished plaintiff's counsel to say, don't go there, approach the bench, stop, you violated my ruling on the cost issue. There's no evidence of that in the record. Judge Stern did not admonish plaintiff's counsel. I think Judge Stern was probably sitting on the edge of his seat, waiting perhaps for an objection that did not come.
Pardon me for interrupting, but would it be fair to say that the motion in limine that was filed in response to the medical record that I referred to when I was speaking with Mr. Epstein, would it be fair to say that that was a sort of general objection to no future stuff? You know, we don't want anything, you know, we're objecting to any evidence about future treatment. Wouldn't that comprehend within that sort of general rubric costs also?
Great question, Your Honor. I think if you parse it out, the answer is perhaps, but not the case here. Two reasons. Because first of all, the care, the future care, the subject of what needs to be done for Mr. North in the future, that was already in Dr. Limbach's chart before January 28th, 2013. That was placed in his chart back in May of 2012. That was disclosed in response to interrogatories to the plaintiff. It was disclosed in their plaintiff's expert disclosures. That was out there. The rhizotomies, the injections, that was already out there. The only new opinion in the January 2013 chart note was surgery, okay? Nothing about cost specifically. So, well, you could say it includes costs prophylactically. There was no mention of costs. It didn't draw the court's attention to it, either pretrial or otherwise.
But
so
if
the answer would be no.
Sorry. Just to follow up on Judge Bernard's question, if the defendant had succeeded on the motion in limine to exclude testimony about that medical record, which included reference to future surgery, you know, obviously that would have precluded any testimony on the cost of that surgery as well.
That would
so
have.
If they would have succeeded, they would have kept out this cost evidence.
They would have as to the surgical cost, Your Honor. I would agree with that. But not as to the rhizotomy, not as to facet injections, not as to trigger point injections. That was disclosed and in the records. It would eliminate the reference to surgery. That's true. But as Judge Stern, he heard the discussion about the motion in limine and said, you know, you sat on your hands for 60 days plus the 5 days while discovery was still open, and you did nothing. You did nothing, you come in today, and now you're complaining. The motion's denied. And he denied it as to that specific evidence.
So, yes, thank you.
Address your question, Your Honor? Okay, thanks. Any other questions on that? Okay. So, the key is there needs to be a contemporaneous objection. The case law is clear, both practically and functionally, but there was none. And it's fascinating that the bottom line on that argument is that the defendant was happy to submit the case to the jury with the evidence from Dr. Limbach's testimony on cost. No curative instruction, no limiting instruction, no mistrial, and the trial court did not admonish plaintiff for going into that area of the inquiry, and that shows that there was no prior ruling. Hence, there had to be a contemporaneous objection, and none was made. Now, let me address the other side of this, and that is the ultimate issue is whether the verdict itself is supported by the record.
Counsel, I guess I'm not quite sure why you think that the defendant's arguments on appeal raise the question of the sufficiency of the evidence supporting the verdict. I mean, I don't, even today, I thought I heard defense counsel say that they weren't raising that point. So I'm not quite sure why you think it's raised in the appeal.
Well, that's not the focus of their appeal, but I think that the court has to look at that issue in order to dispose of this appeal based on the law of Colorado and the case law, that if there's any evidence in the record to support the verdict, it has to be affirmed. And there is evidence. There's evidence in three respects. There's the chiropractic care, and the cost as to the chiropractic care came in through Dr. Murphy without objection, and it had been disclosed. Dr. Murphy opined that Mr. North would need chiropractic care 2 sessions a month for the rest of his life, which was a 20-year life expectancy. If you do the math, that's $48,000 in future chiropractic care on a conservative basis. Mr. North had been treated as often as 5 times a month by Dr. Murphy. If you use that number as the baseline, then you'd have more than double the economic loss based on chiropractic care alone. That would take you over $96,000 on chiropractic care alone. If you fall somewhere in between, you still have a robust number based on chiropractic care alone to support the economic verdict of just over $95,000. Plus, in addition to that, you've got the quality and nature of the future care that's required for Mr. North. And there's no question that that evidence came in. The surgical care, rhizotomies, injections, facet injections, and trigger point injections. Now, the surgical care was described by Dr. Limbach rather carefully. He talked about a two-level fusion, and the jury heard that. So you've got hospital bill, anesthesia, and the surgeon's fee. You've got possible rhizotomies. That came in, and the jury is, you know, we're entitled to have the court look at the evidence in the record deferentially in favor of the verdict. Now, I cited several cases, the Tate case, the Stewart case, saying the jury has the ability under the law to estimate losses. They could hear the qualitative nature of that care and go, well, I know neck surgery is pretty expensive. I know rhizotomies sound moderately difficult. Injections, you can't go to the doctor for free. That there's going to be a cost associated with that, and it will be substantial, particularly the two-level fusion. Dr. Limbach described that. Take a piece of bone out, put it between the vertebra, put a plate on at two levels, diffuse the two levels. So let me mention a little bit of the case law in that respect, if I may. And again, Dr. Murphy was on the chiropractic care, was being conservative when he came up with 2 sessions per month. He said he had actually stretched out the care, okay, for Mr. North, meaning Mr. North could easily have had more care. The testimony from Dr. Murphy is he treated Mr. North as many as 5 times in a month. The jury could hear that and say if there's exacerbations or as Mr. Murphy ages, he's going to need more care. Those could be reasonably inferred. But in Tate, the court said, given that the insured presented evidence of his injuries and existing medical expenses, it was not unreasonable for the jury to infer that the insured would incur $100,000 in medical expenses in the future. While we recognize that amount is a rough approximation, it's necessarily so. In Stewart, the jury awarded the 9-year-old boy lost future earnings based on lost earning capacity and upheld the verdict on evidence despite no evidence on the amount or measure of loss. Tate is really interesting because the $100,000 is close to the $95,000 and the $10,000 in medical expenses is close to the $9,000 in our case. An appellate court will not disturb a damage verdict unless it's completely unsupported by the record. And I cited Averett versus Walmart Stores. I've got 1 minute left. So let me conclude just saying that the evidence supports the economic verdict. The costs of the treatment for future chiropractic that gave the jury a foundation. The existing medical expense of the $9,000 could be extrapolated out in time. Mr. North had $9,000 in care over that 3 to 4 year period pre-trial. That's conservative care. They could have used that as a benchmark to figure what he would have as future medicals to the end of his life in 20 years. That supports the verdict, as does the chiropractic care. I mentioned 2 sessions versus 5 sessions. That runs that out. Finally, the qualitative aspect of the surgical care. That's expensive. Finally, $95,000 for 20 years of future care is less than $5,000 a year, which is very conservative. Fits within the evidence and supported by the record. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Fowler. As I mentioned before, Mr. Epstein, you have 6 minutes and 11 seconds.
Thank you. I'll try to keep it under that. Plaintiff argues that this court must affirm because the verdict is supported by evidence in the record, inadmissible evidence in the record, admissible and inadmissible evidence. So taking that argument to its logical conclusion, if plaintiff had testified, Dr. Limebach told me it was going to cost $1 million in future medical costs, and defendant's counsel objected on the basis of hearsay, and the trial court improperly overruled that objection, and the jury had returned a verdict for $1 million, this court must affirm because the evidence, the inadmissible evidence, hearsay evidence, supported that verdict. Whether the verdict is supported by the evidence has nothing to do with this case. That would mean all inadmissible evidence would be harmless if the jury's verdict is supported by the record, a record containing inadmissible evidence. Defendant's counsel did object to contemporaneously object. He called a bench conference. Dr. Limebach may get into costs. What he said was, this is an issue that came up pre-trial. He is testifying outside the four corners of his records. He said in his record that he may possibly need surgery, and now he's talking about rehabilitation. He's going to get into costs soon, to which the court responded, you can cross-examine him. That was a contemporaneous objection.
But Mr. Epstein, weren't there a few exchanges before the court said that? I think you sort of omitted some dialogue between the objection and the court's ruling. Mr. North's counsel seemed to be emphasizing that he wanted to elicit testimony that surgery would be likely necessary. Hart's counsel seemed to say that's not in the record, and then the court said you can cross-examine him.
But my reading and understanding of what the court was saying was you can cross-examine him on all of this. On all of what you are now objecting to.
Well, then, if that's the case, why did the court later explicitly talk about the ability to cross-examine on rehabilitation if the court thought its previous ruling had already covered that point?
On rehabilitation?
Well, the earlier objection was to any testimony about rehab, and then the court said you can cross-examine him, and then the court clarified that he can also testify about rehab. And that's not consistent with your view that the court's earlier statement that you can cross-examine him referred to all of the earlier testimony to which the objection was made.
Well, he was responding to what plaintiff's counsel had just said, interposed between what defense counsel objected to and then what the trial court said. But my understanding of what the trial court was saying was, you can cross-examine him. Otherwise, the court would or should have said, you can cross-examine him on the rehabilitation issue, but I'm not ruling on your costs objection yet. To make it clear, I don't think it was at all clear that the trial court was not overruling the objection to everything that defense counsel was bringing to him at the bench conference.
Okay, thank you.
Plaintiff argues that there was no motion for limiting instruction or motion for mistrial or argument or objection to argument in closing. If the objection was made and overruled, that's all you have to do. There's no case law that supports the proposition that you have to do it more than once or move for a mistrial if an objection is made and then overruled. The fact that defendant does not challenge other damage components of the jury's verdict is irrelevant because the relief requested is only a new trial on economic damages, not any other component of damages. The fact that defendant didn't offer its own expert testimony is also irrelevant to the issue of whether Dr. Limebach's testimony was regarding costs was inadmissible. And Finally, I think, Judge Navarro, you're right. The initial motion that was made by defendant's counsel asked to preclude all of Dr. Leinbach's testimony regarding future medical treatment, which would necessarily be inclusive of costs. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Epstein. Thank you, counsel. We very much appreciate your arguments today. The case will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course. Safe journey home to the both of you.